Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we're going to be diving into the second Trump presidency, kind of like a lot of the news that's going around this week. I think this has been very exciting times. I think my opening thesis will be that, not opening thesis, but one of the things that I said on Monday was that January 20th, 2025, is the single greatest day in the history of the Republican Party. I don't think there's another day that even comes close to being the day that it was for this party. So that's kind of how I feel about the beginning of the second Trump presidency. He came in and he's ready to go Caesarian leader here. And I think that's what America needs is a Caesarian leader because, the Congress doesn't really work. They don't really function in Congress, and you need 60 votes to get meaningful legislation passed. Now, the Lake and Riley bill is an interesting development that something at least passed that does not, provide for amnesty or anything like that. But other than that, I don't expect a whole lot of legislative accomplishments. We're going to have to do a lot of things through the executive branch and the courts for the time being, because we're not quite there yet with the limiting the Democrats' ability to get seats in the House and the Senate. So I think Trump delivered a lot of W's. We're going to talk about some of the W's and specifically as we go on, but that's just kind of where I'm at. I think that Monday was the best day of the history of the Republican Party, and I don't think there's really a close second. So your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Trump is delivering on the promises and the expectations of the American people rather early on. Again, I am a little butthurt. I wasn't able to go to the inauguration because they canceled it and made it indoors. And that would have been like a pretty great experience getting into the National Mall with a bunch of like MAGA guys, a bunch of bros that would have came from around the country, because a lot of people did come from around the country to check it out. And it's unfortunate that, with the weather and all that, they made it indoors. But otherwise, this week has been the greatest week and probably for America in this century. I mean, let's just be honest with ourselves. We're tackling birthright citizenship, which, that's a huge issue going forward. That's a Rubicon that Trump is actually trying to cross. I mean, he did deliver on pardons, which, again, you had a lot of nothing ever happens bros. You had a lot of doomers. You had the groypers all saying that, hey, where's Trump's going to renege on this promise to pardon the J6ers, even when the rhetoric was clearly like plausible deniability rhetoric. And
yeah, I was actually pretty surprised that Trump pardoned them on day one. Like, I thought that was extremely surprising.
I mean, you're also seeing the rumors that, Vivek Ramaswamy was being bumped out, which, again, a lot of people were saying, oh, Trump's going to, basically go back on his immigration stuff, on the H-1B stuff, when it seems like, although there is a little bit of a civil war happening, Trump is listening to the base. And again, Vivek's the guy that fell on a sword, and his reputation is absolutely trashed right now.
They expect one of us in the wreckage, right? Is that what Trump said to Vivek? So what's interesting about that is the latest story on Vivek Ramaswamy is that, according to National File, which I don't consider to be reputable, but nevertheless, they have an exclusive where they claim that it was his Saved by the Bell tweet that pretty much lost him the favor with Trump. So he trashed American culture and jocks and nerds and stuff like that. And that is the tweet that did him in.
Yeah, I mean, Trump was a football player, apparently, and
tight end.
Yeah. And again, also, Neil Armstrong went to Purdue because of their football team. So, yeah.
Over MIT.
Over MIT.
Yeah, that's kind of an important detail there. But anyway, yeah, a lot of W's came this week, and one W is just too far-fetched. I don't really believe that it's true, is the reports that Trump would extradite Anthony Fauci to Russia as part of a peace deal with over the Russo-Ukraine war. There's no way that's real, but I really want it to be real because that would be a way of getting around Biden's pardon, you know? It's like, yeah, we can't prosecute you, but Puttler can. I think that would be just hilarious. That would be a way to own the left and actually just undermine their ability to govern.
Now, because, I will offer one major critique, though.
Okay.
I mean, Trump did a lot, did away with a lot of the DEI stuff, and he rolled back affirmative action on the federal level, which will affect government contractors. So that's, you know, most major employers, even like Amazon type businesses. However, he did not do it on MLK Day.
Oh, I thought
that would have been a huge slap.
I want to say it was like 200 executive orders on day one, which is, you know, okay. I never criticized Joe Biden for doing the same thing. He did like 146 on day one, I think, is the number. I didn't criticize him for doing that. This was not a hate the game. This was a hate the player moment. Like, you don't like what he did because he's on the other's team. I want my team to be doing that. And then, hey, our guy actually did that. I mean, we should have started 2017 with this many executive orders to undo Obama-era policies. But I am honestly surprised that Trump has learned the job. And yeah, he's gotten a crash course. And who knew you can teach the boomer new tricks?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to 2017, where, you know, he didn't know who to staff his administration with. Obviously, he won an election as an underdog. And
he was a reluctant figure to take office. Like, I'm not sure how much he thought he would win and how much he was prepared to be president.
Well, but as soon as you win, it's kind of like winning the lottery where you have every family member you've never heard of reaching out to, you know, get one of theirs. You know, you have all these, you suddenly have all these friends that come out of the woodworks. You know, you, everyone knows your name and everyone loves you, apparently. You know, all of a sudden you're starting to date supermodels and you weren't picking up, you didn't have any luck before. So it's like that's basically what winning the presidency was like in 2017.
I mean, Kamala Harris's stepdaughter in 2021 was like a featured model. I don't know if you remember that story, but yeah, disturbing things happen to the orbit of the president of the United States. But anyway, I first want to talk about the terms, because I use the term positive world Christianity in the title of the video. So it's important to kind of break down what I mean by that. So there was a book that was written, I want to say it was The Benedict Option, that talked about positive world, neutral world, negative world. Positive world being that the world is positive towards Christianity, that culture reinforces Christian norms, and there is a societal benefit to being a Christian. Neutral world meaning it doesn't really exist. There is no benefit, but there's no cost either. And then negative world is, you know, there's societal punishment for being a Christian. So areas that are being persecuted and stuff like that. A lot of people have written that, hey, we're exiles in Babylon now. We're a negative world. We should be preparing for persecution and stuff like that. So there's been a lot of dooming material in evangelicalism specifically, because that's the area that we cover, for as long as I can remember. But keep in mind, it's not like I was like 8 years old reading this stuff. And people have been dooming for a long time about how things only get worse and worse and worse. And I think premillennial dispensationalism has a role in that. But you would not believe how many postmillennialists out there are also doomers as well. You know, nothing's ever good enough to in combating decline. So they're kind of functionally useless.
No, politically. No, the abolitionists are eating
some food. Abolitionists.
Some. The ones,
because there are actually abolitionists that want to abolish abortion. They just actually want to do it, and they're not going to trip over themselves to accomplish that mission. But, and then you got the premillennial dispensationalists who are often doomers. So, but they're often also politically very useful. Like, they're not politically useless and
So yeah, I mean, a lot of what we might criticize with, you know, the pre-mill DISB, you know, vote for Israel over America kind of voter. I mean, yeah, they are very useful in terms of their voting habits. As they show up to the polls, they're in the primaries, they're, you know, reliable voters. And even though they might not be the most ideologically or, you know, theologically correct, they show up. They're actually useful.
My theory is that we're heading back in the positive world. And I think, I do think this will be the case. There is a cultural hegemony shift. This did not happen when Trump became president the first time. The culture actually, by and large, radicalized against Trump. And now the culture is radicalizing, or I don't want to say radicalizing, but you see there's a vibe shift towards Trump. It is palpable.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of people might complain about the tech bros and how, like, Elon Musk, even Jeff Bezos, who brought his hooker to the White House, or no, the Congress. Then you have Zuckerberg.
Girlfriend.
Who wore a bra, which is literally a Seinfeld episode. You have all these tech bros, you know, sitting, you know, paying millions to watch the inauguration. They're bending the knee to the new regime. Because again, some of them probably aren't necessarily ideologues. I would probably describe Zuckerberg. But, and then some of them who basically went with the old regime, they're switching sides, which that always happens in a giant, in a political transfer.
So which that makes you think a political transfer didn't really happen in 2017.
In some ways it did, in some ways it didn't. Well, it didn't, but there were some people that did make, like, entreat with Trump. I mean, Rex Tillerson comes to mind. But obviously a lot of those people had their own interests. So they probably thought they could game the system. Not necessarily that they're bending the knee to the system.
And now Trump is Caesar.
And again,
so, very fascinating development.
I mean, you know, the name Curtis Yarvin gets thrown around a lot these days, and he obviously just had, like, a huge thing with the New York Times, which may or may not be interesting to people, depending on your, I guess, point of view. But he actually was the guy that said, Trump losing in 2020 was good in the long run, because now, and you're kind of seeing that now, is because the regime getting what they wanted in 2020 did backfire. They came into power with no mandate in a contentious election. And then they essentially had to clean up a lot of the COVID mess. They inherited the Afghan withdrawal. So they sent, and then you had the competency decline.
Yeah, the Russo-Ukrainian war.
Yeah, so you had all these conflicts that just blew up, and
Israel Gaza
which, I mean, a lot of that they instigated, but at the same time, you let, instead of just letting Trump win, you know, be as effective as he was in the first term, you gave it to Biden, who's senile, came in without a mandate, and pretty lost fairly easily, and had to get cooed out of office. Now Trump comes back, it's just like, okay, he had 4 years to stew. And, you know, he also had better understanding of the job, and he also had a more loyal team.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, God works in mysterious ways, and the way God worked here for the United States of America is actually, in some ways, his ways are definitely higher than our own, because this worked out, and you can see how things are going to be way better. I think Trump, for the next 4 years, is going to be better than Trump would have been
2020.
If his presidency was just ending. So this second term is going to be better than the second term he was denied previously. So that's kind of my theory. I think, and I do think there's going to be a vibe shift, and we're going to see more Christian values. And you're already seeing that, like, college football is, you know, maybe if they didn't have their, you know, championship game on Inauguration Day, like a poorly managed organization, and they had it like a month ago, and instead of being deep into the NFL playoffs. But the two teams that made it were the two teams that were wearing their Christian faith the most. Notre Dame and Ohio State. So, and football and contact sports have always been more overtly faith approving. Athletes in those types of sports, football, UFC, boxing, they tend to be very give glory to God types, but it's definitely been turned up some notches this year.
And again, I mean, you can even see it in the everyday culture. I mean, we talked about the Bible sales. Obviously, the internet is shifting towards Christianity. It's shifting towards things that are, I won't say enchanting, but enchantment might be a good word to describe it. But the idea of something being transcended greater than oneself, like the
which
idea
includes
of,
tradition.
Yes. And that's why you see like the orthos, the Catholics really capitalizing, or a lot of people kind of gravitating towards those older traditions because they want something that's transcendent, that's deeply rooted. And, you know, even though they're theologically incorrect on several issues, that people, you know, they want to see something that stands the test of time. And oftentimes you see, you know, evangelical Christianity that just trails the culture and is several years behind the culture rather than being steadfast.
And some very important examples of that. I mean, some people point out contemporary Christian music is just trailing secular pop music. I would like to point out that feminism and Me Too, like the church is embracing Me Too more, and the culture has actually moved away from Me Too. The culture, yeah. The Johnny Depp trial happened 2 years ago, and the culture's moved away. It said, hey, Johnny Depp got screwed. Why are we entertaining the Me Too movement anymore?
The church
is like, yeah, Jennifer Lyle's a victim. Or I could just name more examples. And we need to bring Rachel Den Hollander into the church to teach us how to be trauma-informed.
Yeah, I mean, you have... They literally are trying to Kavanaugh Pete Hegseth in his confirmation hearing with some story from which is literal hearsay from the sister-in-law of his second wife or whatever, saying that he made her fear for her life. They're literally trying to Kavanaugh him at the last second.
Well, here's the thing.
No one's buying it. No one cares. We're done hearing about it. We know the game.
Yeah, I'm fine with just summarily dismissing it because I don't care. But you know, this is a guy who's in good standing in a church and is repentant. And his pastor assures us that he's repentant. Now, he could be lying, but I'm going to give him the benefit of doubt and the preferential treatment that he's a Christian. So he should be telling the truth on this. So obviously, I have nothing to really go against that and even care about what some affidavit from a ugly divorce proceeding has to say. But I got an article that I want to kind of talk about Trump's impact on the church. And I wrote this article earlier this week. I wrote it on Monday. So how will the second Trump impact the church? And I do think that the second Trump is definitely going to be different than the first Trump. So I say that Christians drastically underestimate the impact that a national leader has on the church, or how much the church has on said leader. Perhaps the head of the nation is conducive to the church flourishing or floundering, or perhaps the triumphs of the church result in national blessings, such as more competent leaders. So I'm not saying which one causes the other, is what I'm saying. In either case, it is historically evident that the president of the United States is a reflection of the church. So one thriving impacts is, you can see if one is thriving, the other is thriving. I think that the health of the church and the health of the nation are joined together. Which, I don't know if that was, you know, to Tocqueville that said something similar to that, but in crediting why. And you can see this not just in America, but you can see this in other nations as well. I'm not going to get into any examples because my examples would probably be a little too controversial. So one example is that the Jesus movement happened under Richard Nixon. Or that the moral majority fought to oppose Jimmy Carter in favor of Ronald Reagan. So I kind of want to highlight the Jesus movement and Richard Nixon. Because, you know, if any president, if I had to guess, if I had to bet on any past president being saved, I would probably bet on Richard Nixon.
As in just going back and fighting the first one.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going, you know, we're on President 47, you know, flip the pages back some, and which, how fast can I catch one? Maybe Gerald Ford was, I don't know. I don't know enough about Gerald Ford. I don't think Ronald Reagan was. I just don't. But Richard Nixon, you know, he had some base moments. I know he's bad on the Federal Reserve thing or the gold standard issue, but
no, that one's probably a little more complicated, but he's taking into account that America was functionally bankrupt and therefore he had to do something about the gold.
But Nixon is a pretty good parallel for our times because 1968, 1969, all those riots that went on because of the Black Lives Matter, I mean, the Civil Rights Movement.
Same thing.
Yeah, it really is the same thing. It's the same movement. It just echoes in history. And so were the early 1990s Rodney King riots. It's the same thing.
The Wyatt riots in L.A. are the exact same thing as the Rodney King riots in 92. They're the exact same issue.
So, same people,
same story.
It's just that we turned Martin Luther King into a martyr because he died. Didn't he die at a brothel?
No. Well, I mean, I know he was having sex with someone that wasn't his wife the day or the night before he died.
Yeah, it was something like that. Like, it's pretty messed up. Like, dude was definitely not saved because of how he lived. So, while claiming to be a reverend.
But we'll find out the truth soon.
Oh, yeah, Trump.
Because Trump declassified or ordered the declassification.
We're getting ahead of ourselves. But, yeah, I think that the Jesus movement happening when Richard Nixon ran on being tough on crime and stuff like that. So he ran on kind of a law and order campaign in some ways. And I think that was, you know, it corresponded with the Jesus movement of the early 1970s. I think. Perfectly in some ways, because those hippies wanted order. They were looking for something in life. And yeah, if you watch the Jesus Revolution movie or the story of Chuck Smith, right? He got a bunch of people who were anti-establishmentarians basically to get jobs, attend a church regularly, and partake in organized religion, even though the Calvary Chapel as a denomination does not do church membership. He still got those people institutionalized in Christianity, which is a good thing, by the way. I mean, I'm trying to use like regular words because I'm not going to hyper spiritualize the fact that Christianity is still a religion. It's not just a relationship. There's also ordinances that we do because of the relationship, but I don't think that we should pit one against the other in general. So, and then I cite the moral majority. I do think that them winning was good as well. Under Barack Obama, and this is kind of the mantra that I've always said, but I do have to edit it a little bit. Under Barack Obama, wokeness took over church institutions. It is no coincidence that much of this started in 2009, where Russell Moore went liberal. And the reference there is he wrote an article on Jesus having AIDS. Or the Evangelical Covenant Church adopted critical race theory. That happened in 2009. I argue that the vibes of this country were conducive for this to occur. Because if you remember 2009, you were basically a racist if you did not believe that Barack Obama was going to bring hope and change. I'm old enough to remember that. And I'm sure many of you in the audience are. But if you're a Zoomer, you might not be old enough to remember that. In the 2008 election, the aftermath thereof. So that was a huge vibe shift in the country then. And then the Southern Baptist Convention would go woke. I think the Southern Baptist Convention went woke during the Obama term. I think most of evangelicalism went woke during the Obama term. To be clear, like Nine Marks was woke. The Gospel Coalition was woke. Under Donald Trump, the battle raged in the church over wokeness, feminism, and gayness. These battles were not resolved. But while denominations went woke, the ladies showed themselves resilient as they block, proving to be a lone bulwark against moral insanity. One thing that people say about Donald Trump is that he exposed things. He exposed that we had a deep state. He exposed that we had a lot of issues in this country and stuff like that.
Well, and most notably Russell Moore, but, you know, he called him a nasty person or something like that. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, they attacked him for that, including people in the SBC.
Yeah. Tom Buck, I think, was one of those people. Owen Strand was definitely one of those people, but he was liberal back then. Still is.
Well, and keep in mind, like, when we talk about why the church went woke, because of Barack Obama. I mean, to some extent.
That's me saying Obama's the reason why the church went woke.
Well, to some extent.
The cultural influence that came with Obama becoming president, that is why the church went woke.
Yes. And it's not necessarily, oh, they adopted new theology so much as they just wanted to be liked by the world, and they wanted to have status in the eyes of the world rather than the eyes of God. That's the main reason. It's not necessarily a matter of deep conviction. They want to have status. And if you're like those white evangelical fundamentalists, as they call them, then that's low status. That's white trash. They don't want to be white trash. They don't want to be like them. They're New York Times writers. You know, they make a weekly column for the New York Times.
And I don't know if anyone else has ever made the connection that Obama's the reason. Like, I don't know if any, like, I think this is my original point, that Obama's the reason why the church went woke. Like, that connection, or that is the time period when it happened. And I'm connecting it to Obama being president. Like, that, I don't know if anyone else has ever made that claim. And then Trump is when the church got exposed. I think he exposed the church. He exposed a lot of the institutions as being woke, as being liberal. And because Trump was an exposer, the media was exposed. I mean, I knew about the media back in like 2014. I'm like, these people can't be trusted to tell the truth. But most people did not. Trump was a lighthouse for exposing the media, for exposing the government corruption and stuff like that. Now, again, I don't think we win by exposing things. I think we win by winning.
Yeah, I mean.
And that's what we didn't have enough of in 2017 through 2021.
I mean,
we didn't have enough wins.
Calling out plagiarism isn't actually going to win anything.
Right.
If you're just talking about, you know, winning. Oh, if you're just talking about the exposing the left or whatever, or, oh, nitpicking or hypocrisy calling, then you're not actually in a position that says I'm winning or that I want to win. Right. You're being the beautiful loser.
So many things were exposed while in the church while Trump was president. So Joe Biden's presidency, I change what I've said in the past. So Joe Biden's presidency lacks an aura of legitimacy and competence. In the church, we saw how evangelical leaders also lacked justification for their influence in evangelicalism. Already, many were woke liberals, but it became clear that the leadership of those opposed to one form of wokeness was open to another. Moreover, the old guard of leaders allowed wokeness to make great strides in the church in the first place. So there existed an unspoken competency crisis that has led to many new leaders and institutions emerging. So what do you think about my comments on Joe Biden's
impact? That's what you added to the article?
No, that's what I've added to my take on Joe Biden's impact on the church.
Okay, yeah. I mean, the competency crisis is real. And you're kind of noticing that with the Democrats, the ironic thing is they don't actually have a bench. So Biden has actually depleted all the competency that the Democrats have because they don't have a bench. Wokeness doesn't allow them to have the most talented people be their candidates, who would be unironically white men. And so they have nothing because their entire regime was juxtaposed to hate white men, Christian men, and men in general. And in many ways, the evangelical church has kind of been called out for basically being anti-white, anti-male. So, again, a lot of that was with Obama. Obama was specifically the rise of the anti-white church. And then you have Biden being very much the exposure and kind of the capitulation of the anti-male church. which we're still really fighting in 2025. Like 2024 was a year where feminism was the foremost issue in the church.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with that for sure. I mean, as far as like the number one and two issues to go, I do think feminism and the homosexuality issue are the two biggest issues facing the church. And I'll give you that the feminism is the biggest issue because I think most people know to keep the gayness out, but there's a lot of YouTubers that are trying to, you know, Sean McDowell, we talked about him lately, but a lot of them, you know, Ruslan KD, most of the Christian YouTube world is probably on the side B theology bandwagon because
they're very soft side B.
and they either don't know better or
they want to appeal to the gays and to be liked and to not be mean when it's just like, no, you and any sane society, your people would, or your group of sodomites would be like, you know,
so. Basically, what I'm saying is that the competency crisis applied to the church, and
yeah, I mean, that's been very explicit.
And I think that applies to Woke Wars too, which we've done multiple live streams on Woke Wars too and videos and stuff like that. And that's even the video I did on ReformCon 2025. And so on Monday's video, I talked about this, and I do think new leaders are going to emerge and supplant the old leaders because they did not defeat these false ideologies that were entering the church. They let this happen on their watch. They were the watchmen and they didn't do enough.
I mean, and to give a parallel, you see this a lot in like academia, where academia pushed out a lot of the competent people. So a lot of the best discourse that's happening, or like, you know, more ideas being spread, is happening outside of academic circles. You know, it's happening with the Anons and Substacks and YouTube videos that are, you know, you get history lectures from like Martyr Maid, or you get, you know, Dave Green, who can absolutely wax Neil Shen via new one. And you get better discourse online than you would at a university. You learn more online than you would at a university.
Oh, man. And so much that you can learn on YouTube.
And that same mindset also applies to the church, where it's like the seminaries were putting out crap. I mean, you know, I mean, John Harris's whole YouTube channel exploded because he was calling out the SBC seminaries. And, you know, the SBC seminaries are generally better than a lot of the mainline seminaries that have been bad for years. And so the weakness in the seminaries allowed for better theological discourse to happen outside of the seminary system.
And along that point, I wrote an article in the Southern Baptist Convention promoting Freudianism. That was Thursday's article. So you want to sign up for the newsletter, by the way, because you don't miss any of these articles. If you're on the newsletter, that's linked in the description below. But this person who wrote an article for the ERLC of the Southern Baptist Convention, it's just academic credential of this supposedly Christian institution, this one. It's like all these different supposedly Christian institutions is like, and then this person's basically pushing therapy culture onto the church and pharmaceutical antidepressant lifestyle onto the church. It was just such a bad article that they were pushing. But yeah, so here's my prediction for the Donald Trump, second Trump impact on the church. Donald Trump's second term begins with an aura of legitimacy and a vibe shift where the nation seems ready to give him the reins. He begins with a host of new leaders and new alliances. Perhaps this will be reflected in the church in the next 4 years. Now, I wrote this before the winning started.
Yeah, this was the Monday morning.
This was I wrote this like 2:30 on Sunday night is when I wrote this article. It was pretty late. this article was before the winning started, so maybe I got to amend this to say, and we're going to win. There's going to be a lot of W's in the next 4 years for the church. But that was my prediction of the new leaders and new alliances. So maybe we can add winning to that, because that is definitely on the menu.
I mean, I know we talked about on the previous live streams where Trump or the evangelical church is, or a lot of the forces in it are rejecting the very revival that God is giving them, which again is predominantly male driven and predominantly white driven. And that is the new, Trump administration. It's predominantly going to be.
I got to give a shout out to Hispanics, because as a demographic, the Hispanic evangelicals they're going to the right. They're shifting to the right dramatically. So I got to give a shout out to them.
But I mean, there is a sense in that, since a lot of these leaders were rejecting the very revival that they're being given. And what's more sad is, as we talk about with Jeff Wright, but with a lot, leaders like James White and Doug Wilson rejecting the very audiences that would most naturally gravitate towards them. But the grass is as fertile as it's ever been. And the leaders, again, you're seeing the crop of leaders that will develop, they will mobilize, they will coordinate with one another, because the internet is allowing that. There's several movements out there that are designed to get people from the online circles into real life circles.
How about you describe that for a second? Because I'm not sure everyone in the audience would agree with that.
I mentioned Dave Green earlier. He's big into promoting what's called basket weaving, basically the idea of, a weave where where all the Anons get together in real life. Another major group that does this, Old Glory Club, which, one of the things I'm part of, that's all about getting high, pretty like-minded, right-wing, kind of more of a frat legally and structurally, but it's designed to get people from online circles into real life, to build that network and to build them in regions. So, if you look on their website, they got, like a Virginia chapter, they got an Alabama chapter. So they're centralized, and you're getting a mobilized network of young men that are mostly young men that are highly competent. You go there and you're just like, whoa, I might be the dumbest one here. So,
all right. So that's a good answer. That was good practical advice for the Anons out there. And it's good to highlight that there's actually practical things that you can do to build networks in real life and not just online. So that's the article. That's the first article that I wanted to kind of point out. There might be another one, and that is the pardon. So I think the second article I wrote was on the pardon power of Donald Trump, or the vindication of January 6th. But let's kind of skip ahead to the pardon and how David Bonson, who's supposedly someone who's credible in evangelical circles, was attacking Donald Trump for pardoning 1,500 J6ers. And he equated it to Joe Biden's 11th hour pardons of Anthony Fauci and Mark Milley and Liz Cheney and stuff. So this guy's taken seriously in evangelicalism. Why exactly?
I mean, the whole idea of you can't pardon someone because they broke the law. Okay.
Isn't that why you're pardoning? Isn't that why they're eligible for a pardon?
Well, yes. But at the same time, what is the point of having power if you're not going to dispense it to reward your friends and punish your enemies? The J6ers, I don't care what they did. They should be pardoned because that's your movement. Those are your people. Those are your soldiers.
Regardless. Pretty much.
And you have to reward them.
Yeah, and people who violated the FACE Act and got persecuted, they broke the law.
23 people.
Yeah, they just got pardoned. I'll write an article on that tonight, probably. But yeah, Trump pardoning the political prisoners. That's a good thing, regardless of whether. Yeah, and they resurrected like antiquated laws just to go after these people.
I mean, if you're like Devin Stack and it's just like, well, you know, Hitler and Mandela were, you know, they were radicalized in jail. It's just like people are dooming. It's just, again, you got a lot of idiots out there and, you know, the doomers, the nothing ever happened bros are just eating a lot of fecal matter today. And I don't understand the argument that it's bad simply because they got unfair trials and the government went after them in lawfare.
Yeah.
But that just shows you that people like that don't want to win.
They're and that's the case about David Bahnsen, who is being platformed by the Antioch Declaration Conference, known as ReformCon. And this guy's just going after J6ers, saying that they broke the law and therefore should be punished. It's like, first of all, if you got arrested for trespassing, the odds of them actually prosecuting that case are pretty small. Like, there's a very high percentage chance that charges of trespass get dismissed, just in general. And that's just in real life. But to throw people in jail for years for that, especially when they're let in by police officers, there's so many layers of stupidity to Bahnsen's blue anon screed.
I mean, it is the equivalent of Jeff Durbin saying that that watching a video of Derek Chauvin on top of George Floyd makes you a witness to murder, and therefore you are morally liable to make sure that Derek Chauvin gets executed for the crime of murder.
I mean, that's just
which he has not walked back, even when confronted with that quote in 2024. He has not walked that back, and he has doubled down.
He has.
Well, functionally, by not walking it back, you are doubling down.
Okay. So, what exactly is the difference between the J6ers and the pro-life activists who got persecuted for the Faith Act? Like, what's the functional difference between the two? And I would say there is none. And he has no argument against pardoning the pro-life activist. Or he has no argument for pardoning the pro-life activist that would not also exonerate the J6ers.
I mean, the only difference is maybe you got a couple of eccentric characters in there.
You don't have the memes from the pro-life activists, and it's the memes that are bad.
They had a Viking hat on that is kind of, you know, aesthetically interesting.
Exactly. You don't have a QAnon shaman for, you know, the outside the clinic. So that's another article I wanted to write a showcase. You got an article out today on the, it's on the Trump and the nasty marmy people. So Trump's attacks nasty cathedral, National Cathedral Bishop. You wrote an article on that. So what were your, basically Trump got like woke scolded at a,
yeah. So the national
prayer, right? It was a benediction prayer, right?
The prayer service is kind of like one of the traditions. It's on the inaugural schedule for Tuesday. And obviously you do the service at the National Cathedral to, you know, abide by the tradition or whatnot. And he obviously, you had the female bishop, you know, who kind of looks like a butch boomer lesbian, giving him the lecture on why he's supposed to care about the gays, the immigrants, and, you know, not punish people and not and to protect the religious minority. So it's very universalist, every liberal platitude you can think of, and, you know, just gaslighting, because it's not like that woman has any concern for, you know, the victims of illegal immigration, the fact the communities that absolutely get destroyed and overrun. You truly hate your people if you're fine with them being replaced by immigrants. And, you know, Trump obviously just has like the best response ever to this. You know, he takes the high road.
There's not a low road in dealing with this.
But, you know, calls her, I mean, Again, yeah.
This is a quote. The so-called bishop who spoke at the National Prayer Service on Tuesday morning was a radical left hardline Trump hater. She brought her church into the world of politics in a very ungracious way. She was nasty in tone and not compelling or smart. She failed to mention the large number of illegal migrants that came into our country and killed people. Many were deposited from jails and mental institutions. It is a giant crime wave that is taking place in the USA. Apart from her inappropriate statements, the service was very boring and uninspiring. Was a very boring and uninspiring one. She is not very good at her job! Exclamation point. She and her church owe the public an apology. I love that. Yeah.
And obviously the use of the word nasty to describe a woman is
ouch.
That's what we need.
Yeah. I mean, he's not going to care about the repercussions of sounding sexist for doing that. And I like that.
Just from an optical standpoint, it's a total win because, you know, she could have just done some generic, like nothing burger of a prayer or whatever. And, you know, people might have derided Trump for showing up for a woman pastor, but instead you kind of see the ugliness of female ordination on display for the world to see.
Trump saw it firsthand too. And I think Trump's going to be like, this is why they don't allow female pastors. And Paul wrote that very specific thing in verse 1 Timothy 2. Right, he'd say one, right?
Yeah, he listens to Australian pastors. But yeah, I mean, and then you have the images of J.D. Vance and Trump being rather apathetic and bored during the service and just kind of having to endure. And that's the most relatable thing to a lot of guys out there, is having to listen to like these like unintelligent women lecture them about, and especially reality. If they're young, especially if they're like young and went through like the college and school system in like the last 10 years.
I mean, there's so many memes about it. Like I'm sure everyone here has maybe seen that image of like the obese black woman lecturing a college. It looks like a college classroom on diversity, equity, inclusion, or whatever. You know, she's wearing like the white and it looks really bad on her. You know what I'm talking about?
I might not, but
I there's no way you have not seen that image. But it's like the meme in real life. You're listening to these people talk and they don't look like serious people. And she does not look, like you said, boomer lesbian, does not look like a serious person worth listening to, much especially on theology or matters of moral imperative. Okay, yeah. Roman Shaman knows what I'm talking about. It's like one of the most iconic images of DEI training. So...
But yeah, I mean, it resonates with the American people. It resonates with the average Joe who doesn't want to be lectured by some, like, you know, boomer Karen stereotype on how to do their job.
So we've kind of talked about the W's in the church. What do you think of his speech, by the way? He gave like an inaugural address. What do you think of that?
Inaugural address, about 35 minutes, so a little on the longer side.
No, it's pretty short for a Trump speech.
For a Trump speech, yes. On the inaugural address, though, it is a little on the longer side historically. But again, very fantastic speech. It was, you know, focused on –
I didn't like the boomer MLK moment, but other than that.
I mean, you kind of expect it because, again, you know, Trump still has to appeal to the normies. And the normies aren't quite ready for the MLK conversation. The young generation is there. The boomer generation, not there. And, you know, it's going to take like a Tucker Carlson interview or maybe these MLK files coming out and you actually have audio recordings released of MLK laughing about a rape. Like that might change some normies. But we're on the cusp of that, but we're still a few years away from like the boomer Gen X generation being full MLK pilled. So I understand that there's going to be some obligatory homage, even though Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson should be the ones getting the reverence on January 20th. But other than that, I mean, obviously he talked about the Panama Canal, which
I actually really liked that because what he did there was basically accuse Panama of violating a treaty and handing over the canal to Chinese ownership and management. Yeah, basically accusing them of violating the treaty by handing it to Trump. Like, hey, we said that you could own it, not they could own it. And then talking about the fees that they're charging and mistreating American ships and even Navy ships.
Yeah, I mean, again, retaking the canal.
So, this could be America's Suez crisis. If you're familiar, 1956, the British and French invaded Egypt to seize the Suez Canal. They, what's the way to put it? They tucked their tails and ran in the face of international condemnation, because Dwight Eisenhower did not want this nonsense during an election year as an October surprise in 1956. And they also trusted Israelis military to invade. If they didn't partner with Israel, it probably would have been fine, because it wouldn't have had Cold War implications for turning the entire Middle East to the Soviet bloc. That was America's concern. So I'm trying to explain, like, how this is going to be that, right? Except we're not going to tuck our tails and run at the pressure of the international world order. And we're going to get our canal back.
Yeah, I mean, but at the same time, that is one way of imposing, like, a tariff on China, because if they're able to import their goods into, like, Miami or, you know, the Baltimore port, or even like the New York port, they're not, you know, you could charge them more to cross through the Panama Canal. So again, you could use that as a, like, an extension of a tariff and again, they probably are using that against our exports to make our exports more expensive to go to Asia.
Theoretically, we could just implement a naval blockade on the Panama Canal, and I don't think it would be very hard to take it back. But it's good that Trump laid the groundwork for establishing how Panama has violated this treaty. And it was a bad treaty.
So, I mean, obviously, trying to think of all the bangers. I mean, he didn't mention
Greenland. And the other part is that Greenland is also necessary, because I love that Trump seems very bent on making the Middle East irrelevant, because Greenland is very vital to the Northwest Passage, which is, you know, very mythical. It's real, but it's like people for hundreds of years didn't know it existed. They thought it existed, but no one really discovered it and stuff. I mean, Greenland's on one end of the Northwest Passage and Alaska's on the other end. And, you know, that is also a very vital shipping lane that we should be exploiting more of, because the Earth isn't flat, by the way. So it's actually shorter to go around that way to the Pacific. But we have to work on ice breaking technology and stuff like that. Russia has actually done really well in their icy, like, they go around their northern ocean. They have like an Arctic port channel and stuff like that. They're actually really good on this
front. Yeah, they're.
And this is one of the reasons why America needs to catch up with that on that particular front, is to, you know, that's good for shipping, and ice breaking technology exists. We can mass implement it on boats, and we should be doing this. It's good for fuel costs, it's good for connecting Alaska and stuff like that, and resources. So there's so many reasons to do this.
I don't recall,
and national security is one major issue, because the Arctic Ocean is believed to be of growing strategic importance. So
now, he didn't bring it up in Greenland in the
he did not, but he did bring up Panama, which I thought was excellent. We're gonna make the Middle East so irrelevant in the next 4 years. I love it.
I mean, obviously, he is talking more about the cultural impact of what he wants to do. He wants to restore Mount McKinley, which Obama changed to Denali. He talked about that. Even like Gulf of America is more about cultural hegemony.
Can we rename the forts that were changed in 2020 and 2021?
I think that's on the table, but
maybe it wasn't a day one issue.
Yeah. So I think that was changed by Congress. But I mean, obviously, I think Hegseth can probably easily switch that up.
Now, Oron McIntyre did a video podcast, maybe also an article. He called this, he called what Trump did a shock and awe campaign, which is America's version of blitzkrieg. You know, we don't use the cool word blitzkrieg because it's too Nazi. But we call it shock and awe because it's kind of the same thing, except maybe the one difference being America doesn't necessarily outpace our supply lines because we can just supply relatively easily compared to before times. But he just unloaded a plethora of executive orders, and you know, we're getting rid of DEI, we're getting rid of we're recognizing two genders, we're shutting down a pro-abortion website that was on the government's dime. So he's doing all sorts of different things, and they have no real way to counter these things. They're like, the Democrat Party has been routed in the 2020.
Yes, they did suffer a major defeat,
and they have not regrouped.
And to some extent, they're probably 10 years away from recovering because they don't have a bench. They basically said, if you're white and male, our party is not for you. And you know, even when they have Gavin Newsom, who's the presumed front runner for 28.
These wildfires are looking bad for that.
That looks bad. He kind of has a, you know, looks like Tarzan fights like Jane mentality. You know, he's great. He looks great until he opens his mouth. And then you see the fact that it would be a campaign against a referendum on California as a state. So that's not going to fly. I mean, what, they're going to throw up another woman like Gretchen Whitmer, who will basically just be a white version of Kamala? So they don't have a bench, unless they want to throw up like boring white Tim Kaine of Virginia, which
no way. You
know, I don't want to give them good ideas.
But how's that a good idea?
I don't know. He was Hillary Clinton's running mate.
How's that a good idea?
I don't know. Boring white guy.
John Kerry would be a better idea.
Probably. But they're probably not going to go in that direction, even though that's the most strategic. The most logical course for them might be to go neocon.
Liz Cheney.
Something.
There's no way they're going to do that, though.
No, they might not. But if their financial backers say yes, then they will.
And that should be the goal: is to destroy the Democrat Party's ability to win nationally.
But
that should be the goal. That should be the end goal of the second Trump presidency: is this party can't get elected nationally anymore, and yeah, we become a one-party country.
They truly could be routed for, years, many years, because again,
they're not going to take back the Senate.
If Vance if Vance wins in 28, then you know he controls the census going into 2030, which would then allow a very favorable redistricting map of the South and the Sun Belt. So that would favor Republicans in future elections.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of headwinds for the Democrats, and again, there's not going to be capable of putting the woke away. Like, there's no going moderate once you basically say that a man can become a woman if he so desires.
Yeah, I mean, until they rebuke that belief, which they aren't.
But they're not capable of.
And it seems again, like they just gave like 13 Oscar nominations to a movie that is basically that glorifies transgenderism. They gave 13 Oscar nominations to it. So the left isn't going to cave on this issue, even if there is a cultural vibe shift. So there's a lot of W's happening. We talked about pardons. We talked about some of the little stuff. Let's talk about the immigration one. So Trump has vowed to militarize the border via executive order, declare the cartels as terrorist organizations. These are good moves, and he wants to end birthright citizenship for anchor babies.
Yeah, I mean, the terrorist organization one is very important because that means he can go after he can go after China, which basically exports either the fentanyl itself, or they export ingredients that are then turned into drugs. So they are more or less a raw material supplier for the cartels.
I mean, Trump mentioned something about a soft invasion of Mexico.
So, I mean, yeah, you could start putting more boots on the ground.
It's like, wow, we're going to actually have our military industrial complex serve American interest.
Well, he can also weaponize it against the immigration issue itself because, you smuggled yourself into America. Well, you just did business with the terrorist organization. That's grounds for deportation.
Okay, so Romans 8 Shaman says they export ingredients to Mexico. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine a lot of like the meth and like a meth super lab, you know, like Walter White and Breaking Bad, they're creating the meth super lab in Mexico. They're probably getting.
Wait, wasn't that train wasn't the train robbed in Breaking Bad related to China?
Yeah. Well, they would blame China for the lack of quality in the methylene.
So.
And because it would weigh exactly the same while not being as potent, because that was part of the science behind that episode, the train robbery, as well as the difference between the weight of water and the weight of methylene. But yes.
So, fun facts. So yeah, it was like a 6-5 ratio, I think.
Yeah. So
episode. But where were we? So a lot of W's. One W that came up was the releasing of the JFK files, the other files. I'm like, this is gonna wreck. And the JFK, RFK, and MLK files. And I'm like, this is going to wreck the post-war consensus.
Yes.
Because there is a, I would say there's a 50% chance that the Israeli government is involved in at least one of those three.
I wonder which one.
I highest bet would be the RFK.
I would say JFK.
JFK? I think RFK would have the highest odds. I thought there's like an Israeli pilot or something. There's stuff involved in that, but I would say 50% chance one of those three has Israeli connections. And I think 100% chance that MLK is shown to be a massive degenerate and would get canceled even by today's standards.
Yeah, you're going to have a lot of the Christian articles saying, well, we got to accept the good of MLK and spit out the bad. Yeah.
And George
Washington owned slaves, but we still like him too.
Yeah, I think you're going to get some of that for sure. But
so you're going to have like moral equivalency of like slave ownership to the sexual sins of MLK. So that'll be something to look forward to.
He was just doing reparations for Sally Hemings. Is that going to be the logic? But anyway, it's a pretty interesting concern that the MLK files will be limited to the assassination. I'm not sure.
I don't think so, because
they were investigating him illegally, but because he was a communist agitator, they were investigating him.
Well, they had tapes. Well, with MLK, like that's FOIA, but they keep delaying the release of the files, even though they should be legally accessible under FOIA. Like there should be nothing classified regarding MLK. So I imagine it should be everything. But now the JFK one, that one would be the one where they might have some more redactions and withholdings, but
I mean, that's the biggest thing, but I think this will wreck the post-war consensus.
Well, keep in mind, the fact that he's doing it, first week in office.
Yeah, it's like day four and he did it.
So he's able to capitalize on the social capital that he's going to gain because he's able to say, look at me, the government's corrupt, now I'm coming into reform. And so you have a narrative spin that's going to work very well in your favor. And you're going to get a lot of the, I won't say the online bros, but you'll get like the Rogan crowd. So you're going to get a very loyal base in the Rogan crowd.
And I think that's a crowd that actually will show up to vote for Trump. I don't think there's a crowd that would show up to vote for Kamala, like for real. She was that bad of a candidate, just like I said she was. Joe Biden would have done better as a vegetable. Joe Biden would have done better than Kamala Harris on the Electoral College. Because Trump's ceiling was pretty much that. Was pretty much 312, maybe 322.
I mean,
if you want to add Minnesota,
Virginia and Minnesota would have been the two, and New Hampshire, but
Maine, maybe. Yeah, I mean, Trump's ceiling wasn't much higher, but there's no way that I don't think Trump gets 312 with Joe Biden. I think he maybe loses one other state. But instead, he carried all the swing states. And now he has a convincing mandate, an aura of legitimacy that is not being stopped. So one last thing. We have to talk about foreign policy. We have a little bit. I think Trump is the reason why the ceasefire is existing in Gaza-Israel war. I think that's he's the reason for that.
Which also...
And he is pulling... he is basically twisting Netanyahu's arm to get the ceasefire done.
Yeah, I mean, and this might be the end of Netanyahu, which is a, you know, a day to praise God, given how many, you know, evangelical politicians worship the guy. You know, we Catholics have Mariology, and you know, a lot of Protestants have, you know, Netanyahuology, even though he's like a terrible human being. And this is likely the end of Netanyahu, because his own country hates him, and him ending the ceasefire will pretty much be the end of him.
Or him as, implementing a ceasefire.
Yes, because once Israel says okay, once that stomach for war is gone, and once you know,
I don't think they had the stomach to war to persist.
They don't, because they have an army that's filled with degenerates.
Well, they had 15 months. Well, they 15 months of doing relatively the same thing that you did in the first few months. Like they, here's the thing, and people thought this was controversial. But I basically said that Israel didn't win. That's not to say that they lost. But if you look at the map of the invasion of Gaza, it first of all looks like a penis. And they did what I would call a tactical circumcision of the Gaza city, or what's one of this city in the north was basically circumcised from the southern part of Gaza. But they did that very early on, and they did not really progress in their invasion since. They leveled a lot of buildings. They took very high casualties compared to Israel's other wars. And I don't know how much they had a stomach for this high volume of casualties.
No, especially when you start tackling the Lebanon invasion, where they fared less successfully than they did the last time they invaded Lebanon and fought against Hezbollah. I mean, obviously, they got
the Houthi rebels and the Houthis in Yemen are able to attack Israel, apparently. So there's a lot of stuff going on. I think geopolitically, they didn't really achieve their objectives. I don't think militarily they achieved enough of their objectives. Like, they did not eliminate Hamas from being able to do this again.
They also expose themselves as very weak to attacks in the future. If Iran wanted to, they could destroy Israel.
It's not a contest.
They broke through the Iron Dome with 60, I want to say upwards of 60-80% success. And they you don't hear much about what was damaged, because they weren't targeting civilian centers. You know, they're not like Israelis.
Yeah.
But yeah, they can throw hypersonics at them. They can. The Iron Dome's not as effective as it's been made out to be. That's been exposed on the global stage.
I mean, there was this one guy who called it the Iron Sieve. I remember reading about way back. He was kind of a contrarian military expert, and he was not a big believer in the Iron Dome. But either way, like, Israel can't really claim a W, because I don't think they achieved any long-term objective. And now they have to pay to rebuild what they destroyed in Gaza. Like, if I were an Israeli citizen, I'd be really pissed that our tax dollars are going to pay for rebuilding something.
Well, paying for something and being an Israeli is
okay.
Already grounds for anger, right? But yeah, I mean,
and supposedly this deal could have been done in May. So this is the same deal from May. It's like these people had to be, you know, held captive for.
No, I will say there were
7 months would be longer because you wouldn't take the deal sooner.
There would be two differences. One would be the Lebanon invasion. The other would be Syria, which, I mean, again, that's not as much of a win as you would think, because I would say that the Russians and the Iranians are punting the ball and putting the West into a you know, into the goal line situation and or defending from their own goal line. And they might be able to just return to power in a couple of years. But also you're actually giving a lot of power into the hands of Turkey, a NATO ally, which is not exactly going to be friendly with Israel.
Yeah, Turkey's a country I'd be more concerned about, actually.
Yes.
Because they are industrialized and not on the verge of a demographic collapse.
Yeah, I mean, Turkey is...
China, I'm not really worried about. They have no long-term future, and they have no military success to look back on.
Yeah, I mean, they have a demographic crisis in China. But Turkey is actually kind of rebuilding an Ottoman thing. And if you think about it, Syria being ruled by Turkey is kind of normative in human history. So Syria being a Turkish proxy is probably a decent thing in the long term, but it doesn't actually help Israel.
Yeah, I don't think Arabs are very martial people.
Again, Netanyahu is going to be weaker going forward. So he basically delayed the deal by, you know, a year just to remain in power for a year. So, I mean, and again, Trump's not.
I mean, it'd be one thing if they achieved something significant to say, hey, this is never going to happen again. But I don't think anyone believes that this is never going to happen again. There's a lot of Israelis or Zionists who are hating on the deal, but Trump made that deal happen.
Yeah, I mean, he can claim credit.
This is the equivalent of the Iran hostage situation ending because of Ronald Reagan entering office. This is the equivalent of that.
So the other
conflict I want to, okay, you can have
would
the last
be,
word on
would
this.
Be the rumors that, you know, Trump is interested in making a deal, and that is probably going to be imminent. I mean, it seems like you're even seeing some similar buzzings over in Moscow about what Putin's plans are. So the idea of a peace coming in the spring for Ukraine is probably more likely.
Okay, I wanted to shift to that one, actually. Yes, let's shift to the Russo-Ukrainian war. I don't think Trump is going to succeed in this one. I don't think he's going to harm American interest, but I don't think he's going to convince the Russians to end the war. Because the Russians, you know, the thing about the Ukrainian military is they are in such disarray right now. They're losing battles left and right. At a much faster rate, because the Russians historically they are slow learners.
Well, I mean, this is
you're gonna let the Germans get all the way to 5 miles outside Moscow before you learn how to stop them and stuff like that. Or you're Peter the Great and you're gonna take a few beatings before you actually earn the title the Great. So the Russians historically they are slow learners militarily in a conflict. But
this is a modern, this is like the first modern conflict.
And it's a very interesting one at that, because Russia has been a slow learner in the conflict, and the lessons that they have learned, it's very fascinating. The use of motorcycles in warfare is pretty interesting.
Drone
warfare is very interesting to watch, as a development historically. But the way that they pay their military, like Russia is going to build a middle class of military veterans from this war. Like they're going to make a lot of money in Russian currency from this war. So it's kind of like they don't have a recruitment issue. And the only thing that slowed down their recruitment was Christmas. Whereas the Ukrainians have 100,000 plus desertions. So if you're an army that has 100,000 plus desertions, they're not going to survive much longer. The invasion of Kursk, it has some strategic value as a bargaining chip for negotiations, but you are, first of all, losing, you're getting chipped away there. Second of all, you're not negotiating.
I mean, I think Trump will be very favorable towards Putin because he wants to make the deal happen. And obviously that means selling out Zelensky to an extent. And I think Putin...
Hopefully Anthony Fauci as well.
I think Putin has sustained enough damages to where he would want to... He would have an impetus to take the exit ramp upon a good deal. Because again, he was willing to negotiate with until Boris Johnson sabotaged the deal back in 2022. So I do think, you know, Putin offers terms, he would abide by such terms. And obviously Trump is also kind of a man of his word. So I think you could have, if you have the men in the room being the negotiators and not, you know, these subversive weasels like Blinken or Johnson, I think you actually could get a deal.
Right, said Fred says, Russia has a military advantage, but they're sick of the expense. Putin wants the war over in 2025.
Yes, there is a chance. You're 3 years into a conflict. You are going to start.
It's a 4 year, but yeah.
Yeah, you're going to start seeing some war fatigue.
Yes and no. I mean, like I said before, the recruiting numbers have actually been really good. But part of the reason for the negotiated pullout from Syria is Putin saves $50 billion annually upholding Assad. That's a pretty good observation. And the thing is, I think Russia was sick of Arabs not being able to fight, because the Wagner mercenaries basically did a lot of the heavy lifting for the Syrians against ISIS.
Yeah, I mean, as far as...
And they don't like the Syrians very much because they can't fight.
I mean, as far as field position goes, I think Russia...
And they tucked and run the first sign of battle. Like, they won with, what, 15,000 units were able to overthrow the Assad government because they didn't fight? That's basically what happened, right?
But, I mean, Trump is kind of entering not necessarily a no-risk situation, because, again, if he sustains the war, then that would be bad towards his base. So I think Trump has an incentive to make a favorable deal. And, you know, the media doesn't have the legitimacy to call him a Russian agent anymore. So, I mean, so he has a lot of upside risk to.
I guess my point is that I don't think Putin is good. I don't think you can say, hey, current battlefield lines is a new border of Russia and Ukraine. I don't think Putin's going to take that deal.
I mean, I think there'd have to be more to it, and I think Trump would be willing to give him that extra
the four oblasts that they've claimed.
Yeah, I think he would be. I think he would be willing to make a deal,
with recognition of Crimea. I'm not sure if Russia wouldn't ask for more.
I think they would. Obviously, they'd have to with regards to like demilitarization of Ukraine or whatever. No commitment to NATO, which I think Trump would very much uphold a no commitment on NATO. So, I mean, a lot of the goals that he sought for, I think Trump would actually uphold. And Trump wants the victory of saying he got the deal done and that this war wouldn't have happened if he was in charge, both of which he could claim if he gets a deal, regardless of what the terms are.
I guess my skepticism is I don't think Putin needs to take the deal, because Russia currently is in a very stable position for continuing the war. Now, does that change in 3 months?
No, well, I do think.
But they are doing very well in January.
But the cost and war fatigue do weigh on Putin. So there is downside risk for Putin continuing the war. While Trump, I mean, the biggest risk on Trump's part for making the deal is, you know, whether Congress wants to continue funding this war.
Right. My point is the war fatigue would be measured when you are no longer able to recruit people to fight. Because all their units now are volunteers. So that would be your measurement of war fatigue. The recruitment slowed down, but because of Christmas. Mm-hmm. Or that's a logical explanation. If the recruitment continues to slow down because they've recruited everyone that wants wants more than a peasant life in Siberia or the Urals. If they've recruited everyone, then that'd be a different story. And in a war of attrition, they have the numbers and they're using them pretty well. I don't see them stopping the war without more gains, territorial gains, than what they currently have on the battle lines. So that would be my take on that. Let's get to some questions. I saw a question earlier. So, Kostin asks, do you guys believe that Trump is a Christian? My short answer is no, but I want that to be true.
Yeah, I mean, I think as of right now,
I have like conflicting feelings about the state of his soul. Like, I think he's a lot closer to salvation than he used to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think with regards to Trump, I mean, and you see this with a lot of leaders where even though they might not be personally very religious or very devout, they still value the utility of religion in creating a moral atmosphere and a moral society. So, I mean, even like, you know, even people that, you know, we consider non-religious or like Benjamin Franklin would probably affirm the need for a Christian society. Even John Locke, who's not, again, John Locke is the source of a lot of bad ideas, but even he would, you know, say that atheists should be punished. So, I mean, you see this all the time with regards to like people in power that might not be religious, but they value the religious institutions. Putin would be another example. I mean, if Viktor Orban's not saved, then that would be an example as well. So you see this with like a lot of good leaders. I mean, you know, and, you know, some not so good with regards to, well, you know, a certain guy in Germany in the 1930s and 40s probably valued religion, but not, he might not have been saved personally.
Yeah, I mean, pretty likely not. Mussolini is also a pretty interesting case because he was very...
Mussolini, Franco.
Very friendly to the Catholic Church compared to everyone else prior to him in the Italian monarchical government, and maybe was personally Catholic by the end of his life. But, and maybe Trump might be like that, where he's maybe going to be personally a Christian, like he's going to be genuinely saved towards the end of his life. And here's the thing. Here's the thing about that. Yeah, I mean, you better hope that people don't have free will, because that would be God intervening on behalf of all the prayers that you have sent for Trump to be saved, because a lot of people have prayed for Trump's soul.
I mean, what also might...
That would be God answering the prayers of a lot of people.
But interesting enough, what also might end up happening is Barron goes religious in the next couple of years, or that or that is something that becomes well known. So you have, you know, Augustus Caesar being a very devout man, and perhaps that might have impact.
Barron Trump listens to Haunted Cosmos.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so there is potential there, but you know, it's interesting.
That would be awesome. Let's see. Right said Fred. Ray, who is the fan base of James White? Is he completely astroturfed by some big donor? Can't believe he has any organic fan. Well, I've definitely encountered his fans. So.
I mean, he actually did build up a lot of goodwill over the years. I mean, I think debate me bro culture was a thing. It had a heyday. I think it's been dead since 2020. And James White obviously is still a product of that. And, you know, it's kind of like the dinosaurs living in the Ice Age. It's just... So, I mean, I
don't think he's astroturfed. I think he's someone who has persisted a very long time. And when you spend that much time on the internet doing debates and radio and stuff like that, you do have an audience of your own. So I don't think he's astroturfed.
No,
I do think we have elevated him beyond what he actually is.
I mean, there's plenty of people that are astroturfed.
Yeah, there's a, like, Toby Sumter, I would say, is astroturfed. Or he's just clinging to the coattails of Doug Wilson, and he does not have the talent that Doug Wilson has.
No, I was going to say James Lindsay, but, you know.
Samuel Say. Well, maybe he's not astroturfed. That's more like you're not very good at writing, but you are a certain demographic, and that makes you famous, I guess. There's that. Good question. Some of you in the chat have also been praying for Trump's repentance. And yeah, I think he might be saved by the end of his life. Like, I don't rule that out. I do think Trump seems a lot different from getting almost killed. And I think that has changed him. And yeah, you saw that energy on day one of his presidency. Well, he just went full Caesar.
You know, I God spared me so I can make America great again. I mean, that's a very powerful line in his inaugural address, which was spoken early on. So it's not like it was buried towards the end. That was at the beginning. That was at the forefront.
Yeah. So
you think he genuinely believes that. I mean, obviously what his conceptions of God are a different story, a different conversation. But I do think he acknowledges that there was divine intervention that allowed him to live.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that he becomes a normie Christian. Because, I mean, that would be very good. Because there's so many people that are just... they're not, like, in the online fray or in the know of who all these people that we talk about are. But they just... they've just kind of accepted the truth of Christianity. They're not theologically knowledgeable, and they just, you know, believe. And I hope that that's what Trump is, or becomes, because, I mean, here's the thing. If you are expecting Trump to be saved and then to become, then to do a end a MAGA rally with, and text 10 of your friends, God's not dead. No, that's not going to happen. I don't think Trump is going to do that. He's not going to go in that direction. I don't think at all. But I think Trump could be very normy. I don't want to use the term nominal, but I think he can be a very mild Christian, if that makes sense. And that's what I hope is the case right now.
I mean, you know, to some extent, it might be better that he would be slowly going into it rather than like very gung ho and like, you know, the brightest flames burn quickest kind of thing.
Well, as opposed to you want him to be slow going in rather than a Kanye West.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
or Russell Brand.
Yeah. I mean, see, so there's some good examples on, you know, there's what people would expect.
Or Jordan Peterson. He's not really going into Christianity, but nonetheless, I'm going to use him as an example.
So, I mean, I'd rather his faith be very subtle for his own sake rather than him getting
conceding.
Yeah. Trying to be too forthright with it to where it becomes like a Russell Brand or a Kanye West. So I think that. Because again, that would be a very bright flame, burns out quick.
And there's a parable about that. But it seems like the concerns of the world, to mention that parable, have driven Trump closer to God.
The concerns of a bullet.
I mean, a year ago, I would not have thought that Trump was anywhere close to being saved. But I do think, you know, surviving a headshot has heart checked him, right? You know, that's the way to put it. So good questions all around. Thanks everybody. This is the Angel.
They came at the king and they missed.
Nice. Yeah, they did.
Words of M. R. Little.
So if you like this kind of content, do also subscribe to the channel, to the podcast. If you are new, that's the best way to help out with these magical algorithms. Otherwise, have a blessed day. Stay based. Christ is King. We will catch you on the next one.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.